episode number 68 of Unformidable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded myths in our beloved franchise's quirky history, because to us, every player who dons the orange and blue is, in some way, unformidable. Well, there were two directions to go in current Met news. Not that this podcast is really about current Met news. Perhaps it's more of a respite from it, but, you know, all current Met news in September of 2021 here has either been the 9/11 game or the upcoming Once Upon a Time in Queens documentary. We've already done a Bruce Chen Unformidable because he started the Piazza game, and despite the cavalcade of random 2001 Mets they trotted out during the weekend series this past weekend for the 20th anniversary remembrance, I mean, let's be honest, I'm barely qualified to talk in-depth about the Mets. I'm certainly not qualified to talk in-depth on 9/11, and moving as it was, I'm kind of over all the coverage of it this past weekend. So, of course, I'm just going to go with the topic nearest and dearest to my heart, the 1986 New York Mets. It's very tough. They're a perhaps over-covered topic. Even my friend who grew up, you know, at age 11 when the Mets won the World Series then, and when Once Upon a Time in Queens was coming out, he was kind of like, what else is there to know about this team? I mean, really. I know they're kind of the opposite of what this podcast tends to cover. I mean, I did sneak in a Randy Neiman podcast, but on the whole, the 1986 Mets team was about as heralded as could be, certainly at the time, and even more so perhaps afterwards. But one of the biggest names in that series, of course, started his career with the Mets and almost made the dream not work for our 1986 Mets. The later, after his Met career was over, master of the quote-unquote split-fingered fastball, or perhaps something different, I thought, why not? Let's look back at the career from a Mets perspective of the man who almost single-handedly thwarted that season, Mike Scott. Michael Warren Scott was born on April 26, 1955, in Santa Monica, California. He was a natural athlete who played basketball as well as baseball, and in fact, in interviews, said that he actually preferred basketball, but thought he had a better chance to go further in baseball. While he starred in those sports in high school, he was not drafted in the MLB out of high school, so he went on to college at Pepperdine University in California, Malibu, I think, and established himself as a promising young pitcher with a live fastball, excelling both at college as well as in international competition. He was a member of a U.S. amateur team at the Pan American Games that won a silver medal to Cuba in 1976, and in that year he was drafted in the second round of the 1976 June draft by the New York Mets. The Mets were aggressive with the 21-year-old draftee, starting him in AA Jackson in 1976, and he pitched there as well in 1977, where he did well. In AAA, though, he would endure some struggles and realize something that would bedevil him for much of his career, and in fact for his entire Met career, that he was badly in need of developing an off-speed pitch to complement his strong, if sometimes too straight, fastball. In 1979, though, the Mets were, stop me if you've heard this before, both very bad and very cheap. So they continued to be aggressive with the young prospect. And in 79 as well as 1980, Scott would be up and down between AAA and the majors, starting to excel and master AAA, but really struggling at the major league level. For me personally, those are the first years I really actively remember watching the Mets. I remember Scott well. I remember being incredibly frustrated with him, perhaps because he was pushed by the announcers and the organization, I think, as someone with promise for the future, even at age, you know, 5, 6, 7, I knew what a young pitching prospect could mean for an organization, and that people like to dream on a young fireballing right-hander, but he just, for the Mets, never delivered. It's felt like, at least to a young fan, it certainly felt that way. But for Mike Scott, he would make his major league debut on April 18th, 1979, against the Montreal Expos, coming in relief of Pat Zachary, who struggled in a three-inning outing. Scott would throw a perfect fourth inning, but would surrender a run in his second inning of work on three consecutive two-out singles, culminating with a Tony Perez RBI single. He would escape further damage by retiring Gary Carter, who 7 years later he would bedevil, along with all of Carter's New York teammates, in the National League Championship Series to escape the inning and bring an end to his Major League debut. A week later, Scott would make his first career start and earn his first Major League Baseball win at Shea Stadium against the San Francisco Giants in front of what I'm sure was a thrilled crowd of 10,170, according to Baseball Reference. I went to my first Met games in 1979, and boy, was it cavernous and empty. And well, they'd never let us down from the upper deck anyway. In the game, Scott would go only five innings. He'd allow three runs, one earned, strike out none, which was an incredible thing for someone who threw that hard, but he really didn't strike people out with the Mets. However, the Mets had gotten to Vita Blue early, coasted to a 10-3 victory, and Scott earned his first career win. He'd struggle in most of his subsequent starts, very inconsistent, not going deep into games. He went less than five innings in five of his first seven starts, culminating in a third of an inning outing against the Cardinals on May 31st. After that start, he was moved to the bullpen for a few outings and ultimately back to Tidewater until September call-ups in late 79. And in those two starts he made in late 79, he really showed, I think, what was so maddening about him. In the first start, he went 8 1/3 innings in a 2-0 loss to a powerful Expo team that was still fighting the eventual world champion Pirates for the division. Game went scoreless into the ninth until the Expos got to Scott for two runs. And he would follow that up in his next start by allowing seven runs in a third of an inning to the Cubs in his final start of the 1979 season. The Mets would, of course, undergo a regime change prior to the 1980 season, and perhaps that, more than anything, led to, I think, a more patient and conservative approach with the team's younger players. So Scott spent most of 1980 in AAA Tidewater, where he seemed to finally master AAA. He did get a September call-up in 1980 and earned a spot in the 1981 rotation in spring training. Between 1981 and 1982, Mike Scott would appear in 60 games for the Mets, making 45 starts, and he was not good. With a fastball that was mostly as straight as an arrow and very mediocre secondary stuff, that 95-mile-per-hour fastball didn't really matter that much, and he just couldn't establish himself. You dream of your hard-throwing pitchers being strikeout pitchers, but Scott just was not. In 81, he threw 136 innings, he walked 34, struck out 54. In 1982, he threw 147 innings, walked 60, struck out 63. He had a 3.90 ERA in 1981 and just a dreadful 5.14 ERA in 1982. Frank Cashin later remembered Scott as, quote, a nice young man, and he always had a good arm, but he was just trying to be mediocre. While not exactly bitter about his time with the Mets, Scott did note that he felt he had, quote, no mentors with the Mets. And while, of course, they were a bad team, the Mets did have some veterans, such as Craig Swan and Pat Zachary, on the roster, as well as a former pitcher as manager in George Bamberger, and some developing young pitchers at the end of Scott's term, such as Jesse Orosco and Neil Allen, who were starting to show process. So whether that seems a little dubious, or maybe there were some signals crossed, but at any rate, by the end of 1982, probably the Mets and Scott were in agreement that it was time to move on. In looking back after his career, Scott Simp said, I probably needed a change. I wasn't going anywhere with the Mets, and a change of scenery was a good thing. And so it was at the end of the 1982 season in December that the Mets traded Mike Scott to the Houston Astros for a disappointing second-round draft pick of their own, outfielder Danny Heap. was a minor transaction at the time. I knew little of Heap. I think I was just kind of happy to see Scott go. It seemed very unlikely that the two would both be prevalent in one of the most memorable postseason series ever, a mere 4 years later. The change of scenery did do some good for Scott. He had a decent 1983, certainly by traditional metrics. He was 10-6 with a 3.73 ERA, but kind of the same peripherals, 46 walks and 73 strikeouts in 145 innings. And not to say you have to be a strikeout pitcher, but just that he certainly was still not showing signs of becoming a pitcher, I think, who would one day dominate and become the best pitcher in the game, if just for a year or so. And in fact, in 1984, Scott Bolt suffered with shoulder tendonitis and had a terrible season, and he began to fear his pitching career was over, or maybe not immediately over, but that, you know, he could be a player on the bubble, on the periphery, and so forth. But serendipitously for Scott, after the 1984 season, he had dinner with teammate Enos Cabell, who had previously been with the Detroit Tigers, and raved to Scott about what former Tigers pitching coach Roger Craig had done for the staff, notably with the split-finger fastball, teaching it to several pitchers on the Tigers' dominant 1984 World Championship team. Craig was in temporary retirement after that World Series, so a meeting was arranged between Scott and Craig that turned Scott's career around. So whether it was what Scott and others cited, that his oversized hands allowed him to get an incredible grip on the ball and throw it at a higher speed in the mid-high 80s, a higher speed than other pitchers who had adapted the split finger, or whether it was something else first alleged in May of 1985 when the Cubs claimed they saw Scott slip something out of his glove, and Leon Durham later said he found a piece of sandpaper near the mound. But new pitch or old-fashioned baseball cheating, whatever it was, the Mike Scott, who turned 30 during the 1985 season, saw vastly improved results, going 18-8 that season with a 3.29 ERA, throwing the split finger, he estimated, about 35% of the time, which I guess nowadays throwing your off-speed pitch that or even a higher percentage is more common, but was very uncommon back in that day, as anyone who listens to Keith Hernandez talk a lot announcing Met games would probably be well aware. At any rate, in my Mets-centric world of 1985, Mike Scott having a good year went under the radar. We had the best pitcher in baseball by a country mile, Doc Gooden. We had Darling and Fernandez and Aguilera, McDowell and Orozco in the bullpen. I did not notice that Mike Scott was gone or starting to thrive outside of New York. And in fact, you could probably be forgiven if you weren't paying strict attention or didn't know how much the split finger, or whatever, I can't help saying that, sorry, would take baseball by storm over the coming year. You could, you know, just think that maybe this was someone who had a random career year in 1985, but nothing could prepare one for the 1986 season that Mike Scott was going to have. As a pitcher who, prior to 1985, had never had an ERA lower than 3.72, had never had a WHIP lower than 1.206, would go on to go 18-10 with a 2.22 ERA, 275 innings pitched, 306 strikeouts, previous career high, 137 the year before, and record a WHIP of 0.923, leading the league in virtually every pitching category, and really pitching his best down the stretch as the season was coming to an end. On September 25th of 1986, the Astros clinched the NL West and a date with the Mets in the NLCS, and Mike Scott did it in stunning, sterling fashion, hurling a no-hitter, striking out 13. A week later, in what ostensibly was supposed to be a playoff tune-up, Mike Scott almost went Johnny Vandermeer, no-hitting the Giants again for six straight innings going into the top of the seventh until Will Clark broke that one up with a double leading off the bottom of the seventh. Suffice it to say, though, Mike Scott was entering the 1986 playoffs pitching as well as he had ever pitched, as well as very few other pitchers had ever pitched. And if I knew then what I knew now about baseball in general, and the Mets in particular, I would have been incredibly nervous. But these were the 1986 Mets, and you know, the team I tried to buy a 1986 World Champions Mets t-shirt in May at a game. My parents, having the capacity that I did not, told me that I should wait until after the season to consider doing that. But I didn't care that the Astros had Mike Scott. I did not think it would matter for the 108-win juggernaut that the 1986 Mets had been. But unlike me, the Mets knew better, and the Mets were very nervous about facing Mike Scott in that series, and of course were not only concerned with trying to hit him, but perhaps were distracted by their belief that he was scuffing the ball to achieve or enhance his dominance. Game 1 of the series, of course, Scott outdueled Dwight Gooden in a 1-0 Astros victory, striking out 14 Mets and surrendering 5 hits. Perhaps just because the score was 1-0, perhaps because it was the start of the series, I feel like the Mets had a couple of base runners on late, and yeah, I just believed they were going to tie it the whole time. Wasn't incredibly nervous. The Mets would famously, I think all of these games are very famous, famously win game 2 in the only semi-comfortable game in the series for the Mets, 5-1, and of course win game 3 in an epic fashion on Lenny Dykstra's walk-off home run. But I mean, I'd like to think I've watched just about every Met playoff game, at least in my lifetime. I can't remember one that I missed. And I cannot recall a more hopeless one than Game 4 of the 1986 NLCS. I feel like it becomes something of a footnote, both obviously because Scott did not get a chance to pitch Game 7 and potentially eliminate us, and because it was surrounded by 3 games that the Mets won in their final at-bat, 2 of them epic extra inning contests. But yeah, that was my first taste, I think, as a fan of the 1986 Mets and the arrogance that they exuded, and that as fans we embraced. Alan Ashby hit a 2-run homer off of Cid Fernandez in the top of the second, and that's about the only time I remember watching that team and just thinking, there is no chance we're going to win this game tonight. I mean, you know, Shea and later Citi Field have rocked with anticipation and joy and hope in a number of playoff games. And it's watching from home, it seemed pretty quiet that night. Scott only struck out 5 in the game, but he only surrendered 3 hits. And the only run he allowed scoring, largely because of some impressive Mookie Wilson base running, a single. He did what Mookie did often, going first to third on a ground out to third and scoring, ironically, on a Danny Heap sacrifice fly. But even cutting the lead to 3-1 in the bottom of the eighth, just, yeah, didn't feel like the Mets had a chance, which then forced the realization that Mike Scott would pitch Game 7. And we all know well what happened the next 2 games, thank goodness to those of us who are Met fans, but yeah, it's just, and I'm sure there'll be no shortage of quotes about it and talking about it in the documentary, but yeah, just Ron Darling, you know, said he would have pitched Game 7, of course, and said he felt like I couldn't give up any runs because Mike Scott wasn't going to. Wally Backman was quoted as saying, "As if we had lost Game 6, I wouldn't have slept at all prior to Game 7. Fortunately, the Mets would avoid finding out what would happen in that Game 7, and Mike Scott got, which I'm sure was scant, consolation prize, the MVP of the LCS, I believe only the 3rd person at the time to win the MVP in a losing cause. Scott never again pitched to his 86 heights. I mean, he was impressive in 87, 16-13, ERA 3.2, and got some down-ballot Cy Young votes. Also had the interesting ignominy, I remember this, that Roger Craig accused him of scuffing the ball in a game in mid-1987. And I remember feeling such righteous indignation and justification at the Mets' outrage the year before, thinking, if Roger Craig, who allegedly taught him the splitter, is accusing him of cheating, you know, come on. And in subsequent years, and in, you know, again, these things have been covered ad nauseum. You know, I think the MLB Network has had the games and interviewed the players, and it seems like many of the Astros and even Scott himself certainly dance around the question to the extent that it seems pretty clear there was at least some element of scuffing the ball going on. Scott had two more strong years, though, in 88 and 89. 89 actually winning 20 games for the first and only time in his career. But in 90, he struggled badly, had arthroscopic surgery on his labrum in the offseason. Tried to come back at the start of the 91 season and made only two starts, suffered continuing shoulder pain, and eventually decided to retire before the end of the 91 season due to the shoulder problems in his rotator cuff. Scott officially retired on September 25th, 1991, which was the fifth anniversary of the no-hitter that he threw. And a year later, the Astros retired his number on October 3rd, 1992, which actually surprised me when I read it. I mean, I guess it was a pretty good five-year run. It's not quite DeGrom, but I don't know. Hey, it's not my team. I mean, we're, you know, our team's just cracked not only retiring numbers that are Hall of Famers. So, you know, I guess it still seems a little lax to me, but good for him. And I can actually say that, though I was always frustrated that Scott didn't succeed as a Met when I was young, but it's easy to be more forgiving when you're the winner and you raise the championship banner at the end of the season, isn't it? That's the funny and interesting part about Scott's legacy to me. I mean, if things went differently, he would be now. You know, this was long before LOL Mets was a thing, but, and I'm certainly one to laugh and bitch about my team, because that's just a huge part of being a Met fan. But Scott always just reminded me a lot of, I don't know, the modern equivalent, like kind of like Justin Turner. I never understand why people harp on, hey, the Mets let Justin Turner go, former Met Justin Turner. I mean, first of all, well, not the case with Scott, who only the Mets let go. Baltimore Orioles let Justin Turner go, too. And I'm sorry, Justin Turner spent 3 years with the Mets from 26 to 28 years of age. And, I mean, I liked him as a backup utility player, but I don't think anybody thought he was going to become the player he was. And it just seems absurd to, not like trading a Kazmir or a Kelenic where everyone's predicting stardom and you can first guess the team if the player does in fact turn into a star. I don't think many people thought the Mets were making an epic mistake not keeping Justin Turner on the team. And I don't think many people thought the Mets were making an epic mistake trading Mike Scott. And the Mets had Joey Bautista. The Mets had Nelson Cruz. No, player development is not linear. And, you know, sometimes it happens late in a player's career. Sometimes they discover a new pitch or a new way to cheat. At any rate, it's refreshing that for once the Mets' relative success made trading away a young-ish fireballing pitcher who would go on to win a Cy Young Award with another team and rack up 24 WAR for another team and have them retire his number. Again, not, in my opinion, the strongest number retirement, strongest case for number retirement there is, but it feels like this would normally be the narrative for the Mets, and instead it's basically a footnote. And I guess that's the goddamn flags fly forever mentality, but oh well, maybe there's some truth in it. But for his major league career, Mike Scott wound up 124 and 108 with a 3.54 ERA, 22.7 WAR according to Baseball Reference. He threw 2,068 innings and struck out 1,469 batters. As a Met, over four parts of four seasons, Scott went 14-27 with a 4.64 ERA. He threw 364 innings, walking 122 and striking out 151. And as a Met, Scott recorded negative 0.7 WAR over his four seasons as a pitcher. He is currently 66 years old and by all accounts enjoying retirement. As the only blurbs I could really find about his post-retirement life were that he plays a lot of golf and the family likes to travel extensively. A high draft pick for the team who never was able to find success as a Met and came scarily close to derailing almost single-handedly the greatest season in the franchise's history and rendering 35 years of reminiscing and documentaries and ESPN specials moot. For that and more, Mike Scott, truly unformidable. Thanks for listening to Unformidable. Please go to AmazonAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can find Unformidable and all of our Amazon pods wherever you get your podcasts. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformidable. Thank you, and as always, let's go Mets.